Welcome back to the FKT podcast. I'm your host, Heather Anderson. Today, I'm joined by Andrea Sansone and Andrew Hamilton, who recently set the mixed gender supported FKT for the Colorado 14ers. On today's episode, you'll hear about the dynamic of taking on a huge multi-day mountain FKT as a couple, learn how they developed their mantra, One More Mountain, and hear the absolute worst start to an FKT story I've ever heard.
Thank you, Andrea and Andrew, so much for coming on the podcast today to talk about your Colorado 14ers FKT. I'm really excited to chat with you about it. First of all, have you guys gotten a chance to rest, gotten any sleep?
First of all, thank you so much for having us on here. We're super excited to talk to you. And it's been too long on my end to talk to you. And I know Andrew's excited to be here. So thanks a lot for wanting to talk to us and being interested in our story and our adventure. But as far as recovery goes, I'd say that we're both kind of struggling getting our feet on the ground again. And we say we've been in this brain fog for the last 5 days of just, you know, trying to make it through day by day. And you really feel like you got hit by a bus. So
yeah, there's that saying, you got hit by a herd of elephants or by a bus. And it really seems accurate because like you take a nap and we get up and it just feels like your face has been smashed in. And my feet and my toes are all still numb. It has been a hard recovery, but we went into this and we told ourselves when we're done, we're not done.
Right.
You know, we're going to keep hiking every day. So we've been going for walks and stuff just because we know that if you just stop completely, you stiffen up and then recovery is a lot harder. Mm-hmm. So I think we've been doing a really good job.
Yeah,
for sure. And I mean, definitely there's the physical aspect, but I know when I've done really long things, like you mentioned that brain fog, it takes a while after the sleep deprivation for my brain to just catch up. Like my body seems to bounce back much faster.
Yeah, I think like our lungs and our voices, they're definitely starting to come back. But man, that I think it was just about today where I woke up and I was like, wow, I kind of feel a little clear of the brain fog that's been plaguing me for a really long time.
And I want to say too that even the crew has been having a hard time getting back to normal life, you know.
Yeah, emotionally.
Yeah, emotionally and stuff.
Yeah, I mean, this was a huge undertaking. You guys were out there for 12 days. And yeah, I'm sure nobody was getting much sleep. The crew, you guys, like nothing. That's a long period of time to be out and just doing something super intense. So first things first, we have listeners all over the world. Not everybody is going to be familiar with what the 14ers are. So I was wondering if you could just give a brief overview of what the 14ers are, where the peaks are distributed, just a general background.
Sure. Yeah, I'd love to do that. So
Andrew loves giving the history of the 14er record.
In Colorado, we actually have a large concentration of what are called 14ers, which are 14,000 foot peaks. So in 48 states, this is not including Alaska, it has Denali, it's got bigger peaks up there.
Alaska is its own special thing.
Yeah.
You've got Mount Whitney, which is the highest peak. But after that, you got Mount Elbert. And then we just have this huge grouping of 14ers out here. And so they're in the southwest half of the state is kind of where they're sort of grouped if you're looking at a map of Colorado. But they're all over. There's several different ranges. So you might hear us refer to the San Juans or the Sawwatch or the Songrays or the Elks. That's most of them. There's also a couple more. But basically, it's all considered the Rocky Mountains, but those are sort of the sub-ranges.
Yeah.
And so when we think of this record, first you're going through the San Juans, and then you've got to get through the Songrays. And
you kind of snake through the state in the most efficient, effective way possible, and just to tag all of these 14ers.
And what I love about this particular record is it has this history that goes back so far. You can trace the earliest time when people tried to just do it all in one push back into the 1930s. Mm-hmm. There was a dad mm-hmm. and his son, Carl and Bob Meltzer. They were actually really well-known Colorado-like mountaineers. And so they were the first. And then the more recognized one was when this guy, Cleve McCarty, did it in 1959. So there's this whole history that I get really excited about. And it's definitely evolved over time. And so it went from just trying to do them all in a summer to, I would say, back in 2000, there was a guy by the name of Cave Dog who really revolutionized it. He turned it from this thing where you go really fast in the day and then sleep all night long and then go to a couple of peaks. He turned it into this horrible no sleep sort of thing where you just have to go and go and go until you're done. And he set this time that was unbelievable. At the time, it was like 10 days. And he basically figured out more or less the route that everybody follows ever since.
Gotcha.
And so anyway, That's the background of the 14er record right there.
And yeah. Lots of people have done and attempted these 14ers in lots of different styles. There's been self-supported, there's supported, there's self-powered. So lots of different ways to try to link all of the Colorado 14ers up and trying to see how fast you can do them. In our style that we chose, we wanted to establish a co-ed team record. And so that was our goal going out after this project, is that no one has ever done this as a team before.
Well, as a co-ed team.
As a co-ed team. Yeah. Mm-hmm. And so we wanted to see how fast we could do it together. With Andrew holding the supported record as of now, he's done them in 9 days, 21 hours, and 51 minutes. Our original plan was very aggressive, and we thought that we could potentially try to do this record and break his time. But we quickly realized come day four that we were beating ourselves into the ground and that we needed to slow up if we wanted to finish.
It just seemed like those first 4 days were super grueling. And there are definitely pictures, I think, definitely of you, Andrea, maybe you too, Andrew, like just on the ground. Like
more so me. I was having a hard time smiling throughout the attempt.
It looked so rough and so terrible. Yeah. And I definitely want to dig a little bit more into this. And that was my first question, and you guys covered it beautifully, was because you guys both are part of this long history of FKTs on the 14ers. Nice. Obviously, Andrew, you broke Cave Dog's record, and you also, I think, have the winter FKT. And Andrea, you've done the most summits in the day, and you have the Nolan's record, which is like a separate subset of 14ers. So you guys have this long history within this greater history of this. And I would just like to know, and I'm going to read this actually, rather than summarize it, but when you were writing, and I think, Andrew, you wrote this, your announcement for what you're going to do, you wrote, "We have talked back and forth how we should put this project together. Does Andrea go alone? Do we go together? Do we bag it and not go at all? As we've been through so many obstacles over the past year and a half and have a constant stream of ailments to make this undertaking seem impossible. But here we are. We still want to try because I'm getting old and Andrea seems to always be injured. We are scared. This past June, we have put in the work and scouted many of the peaks we needed to brush up on, and we have trained hard. Maybe by some miracle, we can sneak by with success." I would love if you guys could just talk about what's going on behind the scenes there and what you wrote, but also now hearing that on the other end, now that you've done it, by some miracle, you were successful. Tell me about that journey.
Yeah, it actually, when you're reading that, it makes me really emotional and brings me to tears just because we've been through the ringer this past year and a half. So much has happened, and my mom passed away in September of last year. But as a result of that, Andrew and I decided to go out and just do a Nolan's run together. And that was something that we are pretty proud of last year after my mom passing away, just getting out into the mountains and putting down our own little FKT of a direction that really isn't done frequently, you know? And so after my mom passing away, it wrecked us, and we were just very busy being in Tennessee, being with my mom and my family. And then the other thing for me that was probably plaguing me since Nolan's of 2022, I've just had been struggling with a hamstring injury that I finally decided in January of this year to get surgery on, because I knew that my only chance at this record would be if I got surgery. And so January 3rd, I went in for surgery, and I had about a 3.5 to 4 month recovery period. So I wasn't able to start training really fully for this until mid-May of this year. And so on our blog, we called this couch to 14er record because that's truly what it was for me. And so there was talk of before my injury, like, hey, maybe I can go do this by myself and Andrew can be part of my support crew and we can set up a time of, you know, 10 days, maybe beat Cave Dog. That would be really cool. But then as we were talking and Andrew got more excited about the record and what fits with who we are as people and adventurers and a couple, we really love just doing these things together. We love the experience together and we love suffering out there together. It really brings us really close together as a couple, and we learn and we grow. And so that's really what was behind the scenes of deciding to do this together.
Yeah, I totally agree with that. And honestly, because of her surgery and the lack of training, it would have been better to postpone it for a year. But the problem with this record is you have to put a lot into it. Like, you have to get permission for these private peaks. You got to buy this ticket for Calabria. You got to buy a ticket for the train. We had all these people who were going to be helping us out.
It's Our almost, whole crew was lined
yeah,
up.
We it's had almost so like much we were trapped and we didn't want to just bail. So it's almost like we were trapped into the start date when honestly, it would have been better to postpone for a while. So we both came in. I was having these foot injuries. And so we had our friend who's a PT guy. He was coming over. He was working on my calves and my feet. And so I was starting injured. Andrea just never had a chance to really train. I mean, it could have just been a total disaster.
Yeah. You know? I mean, it really was miraculous that we pulled out of it, you know?
Oh my goodness. Yeah. I can definitely understand then the hesitation in your post and also just why those first few days were so difficult.
So difficult. And yeah, the whole, the first 4 days, it's very front loaded with the most technical peaks of the Colorado 14ers. And so you kind of get like shell-shocked from doing these technical peaks with exposure day after day on no sleep, because the first couple days, you're not really sleeping. We call it brain rest. And so you're out there, you're exposed, you're having these long days, and it's just on no sleep. So it's
I find it interesting because you'd think, you know, we're day after day of easy class five, class four terrain, you'd think you'd get super comfortable with it. But really what happens to us is we get like brain fried and we stop trusting ourselves. And so I use that term shell shocked. It's like, we should be more comfortable on this stuff, but we start losing
our confidence, and you just become this different person where you don't trust. You don't trust yourself.
Yeah. And so by day four, you're so ready to be done with the hard peaks. And we just want to move on to some easy peaks.
Yeah.
And we actually target that day four because I know in the past 4 days, a lot of good athletes, day one, day two, day three, they blast through. But there's something about that day four where your body, for me personally anyway, it's either going to fall apart. It's like your make or break. Mm-hmm. And it's going to fall apart. And if you can maybe pull through, or you're just going to fall apart right there. It's really hard. And at that point in this particular record, you go from these four really fast-paced hard days, and now you're facing a couple of all-nighters out there. It's really brutal.
And part of the reason why it is so fast-paced is because specifically on day three, you are climbing this mountain called Calabria, and it's privately owned. And you have to climb it and enter it at 6 a.m. And so that is this deadline that... For the first 3 days, the only thing that matters is getting out of Chicago Basin and making the train and getting to Calabria by 6 a.m. on day three. Now, we didn't get to Calabria at 6 a.m. We got there at 7:15, but I had been in communication with Carlos, who graciously let us in late. But it was just, it's so difficult to meet that time frame where you have to go, 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 go. You don't let your body get the sleep and the rest that it needs because you're really focused on this third day peak.
Yeah, that's definitely something very unique, I feel like, to the 14ers. And maybe you can just expand upon this a little bit, but the idea of a mountain being privately owned, like, are the summits owned? Is it the access points that are owned? Like, how does this process work with getting permission from the landowners? Just walk people through that because it's a very foreign concept in most of the country, I think.
Well, you know, it's different for some of the different peaks. Colorado had this rule. It was supposed to protect landowners if they want to open up their land to the public. But those sneaky lawyers figure out a way to sue landowners if someone got hurt on their property. Mm-hmm. And so there was a big case that went through where a mountain biker got injured on Air Force property. After like 10 years of litigation, they won. And the Air Force had to pay him like $7 million. And so this scared a bunch of these landowners, like they can't even get that much insurance. And so would you feel comfortable opening up your land if someone's gonna go in a mine that's on your land and maybe get injured and sue you? Probably not. So we totally understand why they're closing their land. The good news is that the law just got addressed this year. The governor signed a new thing that's supposed to give them more protection. So we're hoping that some of these private peaks are going to be opening up. They haven't yet. I'm not sure why, what's going on behind the scenes. Mm-hmm. But so the way it works is there's some difficult ones. One of the hard ones is Calabria. It's privately owned. But the good news is early in the season, you can buy a pass. You buy a ticket, but now you're stuck to that date. They're not very flexible. Andrea was working Carlos for months because we were like, that's really hard to make 6 o'clock. And so she called him.
I'm emailing him. I'm like, hey, Carlos, we're slow.
Yeah.
We're not going to make it by 6 o'clock. Is there any way you can let us in later?
Yeah. So she had talked to him. That was good. And then the Lindsay owner, he's very private. And so he was very concerned this was going to go public. So we told him, we're going to keep your name private. We're not going to publicize. It's just, and he was willing to just to give us the permission to go. Yeah. So that was pretty spectacular.
It was amazing. It was really hard to get him. I emailed him for months and I was very persistent. He had no idea who I was. And so I was like, hey, we're going after this record and we need access to Mount Lindsay. Can we please climb your mountain? And after months and months of back and forth, he was like, yes, go ahead, climb it, but just please respect my privacy. And so we want to respect the landowners and we want to be a good example to the community as well. And so I think that there is a fine line and a balance that you need to respect these landowners. So you need to get the permission. But in order to do these records, you also have to climb these mountains. So it's tough.
And the other one that's difficult is called the Calibron. That's short term for Democrat, Lincoln, Cameron, and Bross. And there's four of them there that are a problem. The owner, he's tried. He really wants it to be open. He's a great guy. He's like our grandfather.
We had lunch with him.
I was like,
tell him we gotta get together.
Yeah.
We need to talk to him about this record. We're trying to set.
And he's even thrown in the towel. He actually sold Democrat back to the BLM. So it's open now.
Yeah.
He's got these great mines up there. He really loves the mining and the history of those peaks too. Again, for him, it was just that fear of getting sued, you know, but he was willing to give us permission too. So it's the sort of thing where people, you can get permission, but it takes a lot of groundwork,
a lot of study.
And it wasn't something we just got with an overnight phone call. Talking to these people for months, we had dinner with John. We heard his whole side of the story. He cried when he was in there a couple of years ago, and this committee by 3-2, they didn't pass this change to the law. And he was so upset. I mean, he cried. Yeah. So he really wanted this he really wanted to open them up.
You know?
So anyway, it's not easy, but it can be done.
And I think we've just found that a lot of people going after 14er records, they realize it's a lot of work. And we know it's a lot of work. And we just choose to put in that work.
Well, it's really Andrea. Andrea's is really persistent.
I'm very persistent.
Yeah,
Andrea. I'm a pain in the butt. I'm like, I'm going to get this done. Yeah. And I'm not going to quit until I get my way.
Oh my gosh. That seems like it worked for you to be super persistent. It's such an interesting additional level of complexity to a mountain FKT.
It's so complex.
It's so annoying. And hopefully with this law change, maybe that's going to get better.
It should be. Fingers crossed. Yeah,
fingers
it should
crossed,
get better. And it everybody. Should open up these peaks for the public, which is what we want and what the landowners want as the end goal as well.
I think so. Yeah.
Right. Yeah. Because I mean, this much tension or whatever, this complexity isn't good for anybody. It's just stressful for both sides.
It's so stressful. Mm-hmm. It makes people angry.
Yeah. Yeah, right. It does.
Yeah. Okay. So switching a little bit away from the history and the background to the actual effort, you guys mentioned you weren't able to really start training until mid-May or whatever. And I read a couple of your blog posts about the scouting trips. Can you just talk a little bit about what that training entailed for KT itself?
So I guess after our Belize trip, that was kind of key in our pivotal moment of training.
We were supposed to be training, but we went to Belize.
Yeah, we went to Belize instead to go.
I mean, that sounds pretty good to me.
But after we got back, that was it's June, pedal to the metal. We've got 1 month of training to do as much as we can and to fit in as much training as we can. And this is probably why I'm injured all the time. But but so we picked the mountains that we needed to scout and we put together a bunch of link ups. You know, there was the San Juans, it was the Sangres and the Elks. And those were the hardest peaks. We needed to get our technical climbing dialed in. We needed to get some scouting in. And so we put together three big training trips that linked up at least, I'd say, five or six peaks per trip. And we would just get out there and have these really big days in the mountains. And I think really those days that really kick our butts is what can kick us into shape fast too. I mean, and I think that we do have a base. So we do have years of experience. So we're not just putting ourselves out there saying, hey, we're going to go try this on a whim. We know what we're getting into and we have a base fitness. And so I think that how we did our training was as best as we could for what our situation presented in front of us.
Yeah. And for me, most of the pressure of navigating was going to be on me. I've climbed these mountains several times. And when Andrea does a record, like, she doesn't mess around like in Nolan's, like, she did those peaks over and over and over till she knew it like the back of her hand. And for me, a lot of these other peaks that we haven't done as much, I've still done them a ton. In fact, during this record, I climbed my 1,000th 14-er, counting all the, wow, the repeats. So I've been up them a lot. And I don't navigate like a lot of the new generation that just downloads the routes and has them on their phone or their watch. I still just do it by memory. So I still make mistakes out there when it would be easy if I just had the route on my stupid phone, but I don't. But I do a lot of it by memory. So I like to refresh my mind on them over and over. If I haven't seen it in a couple of years, I'm going to forget exactly where we're going.
And
so
being out there right before refreshes both of our minds. Yeah. It's like we were just out here, so we remember. And so it's just really helpful to know that we were just out there in the past month doing all of these mountains. I mean, we did half of the 14er record in all of our training trips in those 3 weeks. And so it was really nice to have it fresh in the back of our heads. Yeah. With these trips.
The other thing too was this was a weird snow year in that it was an average looking snow year if you look at the snowtell data, but snowtell is this thing in Colorado where they capture the snow levels and so you can compare graphs from year to year. But the thing is they don't capture anything over 12,000 feet. Mm-hmm. And so it was a weird year. We had these late season snows. There was a ton of snow up high that wasn't captured. It was supposed to be all melted. Mm-hmm. So in these early season trips, we were getting freaked out by the amount of snow that was still up there. We don't want to have to be dealing with snowshoes and stuff like that.
I mean, it took us hours longer to do this mountain San Luis. Yeah. That should have taken a few.
It was, so much snow. And in the end, it actually worked out. We started and it melted out. But
we
started
at the perfect time.
We were freaking out about those conditions. Like, you wouldn't believe how slow it makes you to have all that extra snow and stuff like that. So anyway, that was the plan. We wanted to see as many of them as we could in that short amount of time, just so we know what the current conditions look like and just kick our butt and get us in shape.
Yeah. Aside from the snow, which I definitely remember seeing pictures in your training blogs, did you run into anything else that was unexpected? Or when you were out there, were you just like, oh gosh, like I didn't remember this at all, or major things that had changed?
Well, if you don't mind, I'll give you the story of day -1.
Yes, please.
So, so we're headed down there and actually it looks like we've got this great weather window. So we're super excited about that. And as we're driving down to Durango, there's these rainbows and cool cloud formations. We're like, wow, what a great omen, you know? So anyway, the way this record has to start pretty much for anybody in the future is you have to get on the Durango to Silverton train. You're off the clock. You take that up to Needleton in what's called Chicago Basin, and that's where you're going to start the clock from. So the reason it's really necessary is it's a long haul to get in there, and you want to do that while you're off the clock. And so then when you're up there, the starting point is like 11,000 feet. So you're 3,000 feet below the first summit. You just hit start, and that first day goes, you need to do those four peaks. You come down, you catch the train, which takes you to Silverton, and off you go. So that's a key part of any of these 14-er records. Well, so a few weeks ago before the start, there had been a big rock slide down there and the train had been shut down for a couple weeks. So we were keeping an eye on that. And it's kind of a big deal because Silverton is this small mountain town and they depend a lot on the tourist revenue from that train.
Yeah.
Right.
So
they
want to get that train open.
They want to clear as fast
as possible. Yeah, they are motivated to get that train open. So they did it and it was running for at least a week, no problems, right? So we get down there and Andrea sees this text about a rock slide. And I was like, oh, I'm sure that's just the old one.
It's
fine.
Don't worry about it. I was
So anyway, we get on the train and this is the day before the whole thing's supposed to start. We've got our friend Dan, but he was going to be carrying the camping gear up for us and then breaking it down and meeting us down at the train. You know what I mean? So, and we're sitting on the train and the conductor comes out and she's like, we've had another rock slide. The train, the tracks are closed going to Silverton. But we can still get you guys to Needleton. And so
I do remember asking, is it at all possible to get to Silverton tomorrow in any way? And she was like, nope, that's not going to happen.
Yeah. So it turns out those beautiful rainbows and cloud formations, well, it rained like all night long.
Yeah.
And so
it was a disaster.
Yeah. And so there was this big mudslide up there. So we're sitting on the train. It's going to leave in 20 minutes and we have to come up with a plan B. And plan A is already this super intricate plan on day one. It's like catch the train, get to Silverton, get a 5-mile ride to the ATV, which is waiting to take us over overpass. Where my mom's waiting on this side. Anyway, super complicated. That's all out the window now. We got to figure out a plan B. So what are we going to do? Well, Dan, stay on the train. Go up there and make camp. Andrea and I, we get off the train.
We'll figure it out.
Yeah. And so what we come up with is there is a hiking route in from Purgatory. It's an extra 10 miles. So we're like, okay, well, we could ride our bikes on that trail and we can leave our bikes at the wilderness boundary and we'll go up from
there. Because past the wilderness boundary, you can't have any bikes. Yeah, but they're okay before the wilderness boundary. So we're like, well, let's utilize our bikes.
Yeah, so we're going to take our bikes down there. And anyway, it's not a good biking trail. I was thinking, hey, on bikes, we can knock this out really fast. It's all downhill. On a map, it looks like it's downhill, but actually
it's up and down. And it's this overgrown single track with huge boulders. Yeah. Yeah. And we're pushing our bikes up and then we ride it for 1 second and then we're pushing our bikes again.
And this is also the way we're going to be getting out now because we can't take the train out. We're going to have to come out this 10 miles. It's extra. And
extra
so
effort.
We're like, well, we can't ride the bikes out. So we're just going to have to leave the bikes down here and have the crew push it out. And we're just going to have to hike out the next day. That's what we're thinking. So we get down to where there's 6 miles left along the railroad tracks. There's a trail kind of follows the railroad tracks up there. And well, it turns out that that trail had a bunch of mudslides on it, too.
So
now we're down there. And the first couple, one of them was like this big rock slide pile thing where we're hoofing these bikes over these loose boulders that have all fallen
down. Had our bikes and we hiked our bikes probably 9/10 of the time we were supposed to be riding them. It was such a waste of energy.
Yeah, we were pushing the bikes the whole time. And then after these first two, we hit the real mudslide. It took us over an hour to get through this thing. It was like at least knee deep mud. And so we're trying to walk across these logs and dragging these bikes through the mud.
If you're not stepping on logs and boulders, then you're sinking to your knees in mud.
Did you ever just think, maybe I'll just leave the bike here and let the crew get it from here?
We're too far in.
At that point, once we got through that last mudslide, it took an hour. We're like, we can't come back through here. But our only other option would have been to take the railroad tracks, which is private property. At that point, we were thinking, we're just going to have to ask him for grace because we'll tell him about the mudslides. They'll probably be okay for safety's sake. We've heard like they have to take you out of there if you're down there and you don't have a ticket for safety's sake. So maybe they'd cut us some slack.
Maybe they would cut us some slack.
Yeah, that's what we were hoping for. And meanwhile, I broke a couple spokes on the bike. It's just a total disaster.
Right. And so we're expending calories. Yeah. It's hot. Right. We're dehydrated. Yeah. We're expending
so much
energy. I was like
pouring sweat and I felt like I was wrestling the Hulk in the mud.
We're talking about a day where we're supposed to be leisurely riding the train in.
So, anyway, we drop our bikes off at the wilderness boundary and hike up into Chicago Basin. We meet up with Dan. We're totally exhausted. Our feet are soaked full of mud. We're a total mess. And it's almost dark.
It's almost dark.
What we were expecting to take like an hour and a half or something took like almost 8 hours.
Almost eight hours.
Oh my God.
And that's our way out, you know? And so we actually started floating the idea through our satellite tracker with the crew. It's like, hey guys, can we delay? You know,
can we do a restart?
Can we do a
restart? We wanted a restart. We were like, this is just insane. It's not going to work. And so,
Just with the schedule though, with the train in Culebra, it was just such a hassle. We didn't know that it would work. And Andrea finds out from this weather guy, Chris Tomer, who helps us out, that we had our good weather window now.
Right. So our whole crew was prepared. Yeah. They had the time. And so they were like, we could do a restart if that's what we need to do. So my last resort was texting Chris Tomer. And I said, hey, Chris, what does it look like if we delayed a week? And he gave us the next 8-day weather window, which was clear. And he said, after that, the monsoons pick up. And that was our answer. That was like, okay, this is our window. We have to do this. We can't do this record in these monsoons that just make it at a whole new level of difficulty. So we were like, the time is now. We're just going to start and see what happens tomorrow. See what happens and how we're going to get out.
And I know that night, once we decided we were going to try it. And in the end, we were like, well, let's just try day one and see what happens.
Right.
Maybe if it's a disaster, we could still restart. But I remember telling Andrea, hey, sleep with all your wet socks and your wet shoes in your sleeping bag with you. Maybe they'll dry out.
Yeah, I was like, no.
Yeah, she wanted nothing to do with that. So the next day, we were going to be starting with dirty, wet feet. Not a great way to start this thing.
We were messy. Yeah. We were dirty. Yeah. We were muddy. Yeah. And it was just a horrible way to start. Yeah. But we got up. Yeah. And at 4 a.m., we started. Really shortly after, which kind of was a pivotal moment. And just our way of deciding, hey, we're going to see through this and we're going to go. And maybe all of our bad luck's behind us. Mm-hmm. But as to like probably 5 or 10 minutes after we started hiking up, Dan on our support crew, he came sprinting up behind us and he's all out of breath. And he's like, the train is running to Silverton. So it was open and they got somehow, the mudslide cleared.
Somehow they got it cleared. Later, we found out on the train that they had all the equipment there from the earlier landslides. So they didn't have to transport all the equipment in there. They had it right there. It wasn't as big as the last one. So they got it cleared in one day.
Yeah.
So all that hassle, we could have just hiked up there and just relaxed and it would have been fine. But instead, that's how it started.
And so the only thing we could say was, hey, it'll make a good story.
It'll make a good story. So that was day negative one. That was rough.
Yeah.
I mean, that's quite honestly the worst start of an FKT story I've ever heard.
The worst.
The worst one.
Like, I mean, what a nightmare. Mine has been blown.
It's so horrible, like starting with wet socks and dehydrated and
awful
energy.
Yeah. Like in the worst, horrible scenario you can imagine.
My gosh.
But, you know, in hindsight, we know the alternate plan of going out that way. It never would have worked.
It wouldn't have worked. That was imaginary.
So it was really a miracle that they got the train.
Yeah. It wouldn't have worked to bike out of there, hike out of there. Yeah. Anything other than taking the train, it's not going to work.
Not worth it.
Yeah. So obviously you mentioned about your crew in this story, and it seems like your crew is very pivotal. Can you talk a little bit about these crew logistics, like how many people you had on your crew, who was doing what, where? Talk about your crew and how that was part of this.
We would love to, because the crew for us was just absolutely critical.
And can I add in real quick, real too? That is one thing that is amazing about these supported records that you don't get with self-supported and unsupported. Really, this amazing experience with all these people. Like a lot of them didn't know each other. They've got the building blocks for like lifelong friendships now for the crew.
Yeah.
They're all really good pals. So just this experience for everybody, it's really amazing.
Yeah. For us, it was the crew and the community really pulled us through this record. And I didn't realize how pivotal, I mean, aside from our crew, like the community was going to be, the encouragement from the forum and the text messages and the phone calls and the video messages and the Instagram messages. When we were at our lowest of lows, the community really came through. And so aside from our crew, we have to give the community a ton of credit.
At one point, Andrea was really hurting and I sent out a message on the 14ers forum. I was like, man, Andrea's hurting. She could really use some positive messages. And a few hours later, we're on Kit Carson. And we started reading some of those and they were really just bringing us to tears,
Start crying.
Yeah, just, you
and
know.
And I'm just like, wow, these people actually believe in me, like wholeheartedly believe in us and our attempt. I mean, I just think that's the coolest thing ever.
Yeah,
so
yeah.
Anyway, they're part of our crew as well.
Yeah, totally.
But our crew, we had a good like 10-person crew.
First and foremost, it's like, my sister and her husband, Dave, they've been a part of my record since I was in my 20s. And so she really knows me. And she knows sometimes I have these big dreams and she knows I'm wrong. Like I have these big plans to really cut down on transition times. Like, oh yeah, we're going to get this done in the van. And she was like, you're crazy.
You needed that time.
Yeah, you forgot. She remembers how miserable I am. And she also knows all these routes. But her role specifically,
in
the past, we've just given them too much. So what was great about having a big crew this time is her main focus was going to be on food. She's really good. Like she'll make us some food that we'll eat and she'll like cook a stick of butter into a little bit of eggs. So
I mean,
that we are getting
calories.
The croissant
she makes us are like 900 calories.
That's amazing.
And that was actually, we were really happy with how we didn't fall into this thing where we couldn't eat. A lot of times we're not hungry for it, but we'd always put down what they gave us.
We always ate her food. It was always delicious and it was always high in calorie. And basically how it went was when we got back to our van, known as Beast, we would, those big calorie meals. And so that would set us up for our next big hike or our next big leg. And so where on the mountain, we would just take race food, some trail mix that we were really loving, some goos and gels and things like that. And so really her and Dave's role were pivotal in the fact that they kept us fed and our calories up while we were down with our crew. So,
yep.
And Dave.
And Dave, he's also like the quietest, most humble person ever. But he's so good. Like, he'll do anything, and he's really good. Like, he'll hiking with
us. He's so fit.
Yeah, he's super fit. And so we love having him there. Also, he's just got this personality that won't clash with anybody.
Yeah.
And so he's a really great guy to have on a crew. And so then, past that, we also had, which was an amazing surprise, we had this guy, John, who had this OHV. And we were just picturing it being like an ATV to get us over these mountain roads and stuff. We figured it'd be really bumpy. And so we didn't realize what an asset he was until we got on for the first time. And when we got strapped on to that thing, it wasn't like putting on a seatbelt.
No.
It was like a full-on chest
this
harness.
This was like a spaceship. Like, you're going to the moon,
we're getting,
baby.
Like, we're on a Disney ride. And then when he took off, he had his buddy, who was also named John, who was like a mechanic there. And the way those two guys were working together as like a navigator and working all these dials and stuff, it immediately, I felt like it was Han and Chewie from Star Wars, you know, doing all the calculations to go to light speed. And then, you know, God.
There we go.
And so those names stuck with them. They're now Han and Chewie.
And
the OHV is called the Falcon.
That's amazing.
And so they were amazing. And John, actually, he did all the 14 years in 30 days just as a personal challenge once. So he had a really good understanding of all the routes. And he's just also got this personality that everybody just loves. So chill. And Chewie is as well.
Yeah,
so after
Dan
that, we had also Dan and Megan. So Dan is a guy we called the Beastmaster because it's his van that we were using. And he's done a 14er record self-supported. So he has a very good knowledge of the logistics and stuff. And later he was very important when we were hurting and my brain wasn't working so well. And we had to reroute because we were getting our butts kicked. He was really instrumental in helping us figuring out how to reroute and stuff like that. So he was great to have.
And Megan, he did the driving. So that
was a lot of the driving.
Really
the Beast.
Yeah,
very critical. Yeah. That Beast is a very capable van, a lot better than my old van. That thing is lifted. It can do all those 14er roads, you know. Yeah. And so anyway, then we had Megan was a big surprise. Like when the first couple of days, we mainly had those guys there. And what we discovered is we were really disorganized. And when Megan got there, she really helped get the organization going. And it was a big boost for Andrea just to have some female energy there.
Yeah, because we just realized that in the beginning of the first day or so, we're trying to sort through our gear and we're trying to go under three duffel bags just to get a hat. And Andrew's breaking fingernails and then he's trying to tape his feet. And we don't know where this, that, or the other is. And so coming off of the Wilsons at the end of day one, I just realized that I needed a better transition. And so I was like, Andrew, we need to take some time and we need some organization in our transitions. And that's where Andrew really wanted to cut the time. But because we were missing this kind of key element at first from our crew of the organization, the packing of the packs and things like that, we needed to do that ourselves and we needed to figure that out. So Megan was pretty critical in that organization and seeing through our gear. So that was really important.
And then we had this other guy. So Randy, he's a friend of ours. He's like 80. And
he's amazing.
Was super excited to help out. He had the whole time
off. He took off the entire month of
July. He was so instrumental. He was like the errand boy. And so many times we needed someone run into town.
Like,
go get these bolts fixed. Oh, now the AC on the van wasn't working. So he had to drive to Gunnison with the mechanic and go get parts to fix it. Like, he was so critical and he was so excited to be there.
He was so excited and just wanted to support us.
So
that was really.
And I don't want to forget anybody, but the biggest surprise.
Well, also Chris Muser. He was our PT guy.
Oh, yeah. And beforehand, we had this PT guy and he was working on me trying to solve my injuries beforehand. And so he was coming here day after day. And then he met us a few times out there. That was pretty critical. I don't know if anybody else has ever had a guy show up with a massage table, throwing us both up there, you know, working us out, you know, when we're in transition. And he had to do it with all this pressure because he'd just get set up and he'd get one of us on there. And Dan would be like, hey, are you ready? Are you ready? Are you ready? We gotta go. And so he had to do it all under this huge amount of pressure.
Yeah.
So that was amazing.
And then I would say last, but absolutely most, I would say most critical and not least, my sisters.
And originally we thought they were just, they have no experience in this. We thought they were just going to show up and be like cheerleaders, sort of like fish out of water, not knowing what they're doing. They ended up saving the day. Because,
they were incredible. Not only did they fly in, I think it was like on day six, and they flew in and they met us at Holy Cross And that was a pivotal moment in where I was developing this knee injury or this nagging knee issue in my left knee. And I was having breathing issues and lung issues. And my sister, Nicole, she's a physician assistant. So all of her medical knowledge just puts me at ease. And then Lauren, she's just there for you. She's there. She wants to help. She wants to be a part of it. And so with them coming in with absolutely no experience, they jumped into this crewing role, I mean, as masters. And they they fit in so well. And they helped with food. They helped with gear. They helped with organization. They helped with our injuries. They helped with dressing us. I mean.
And from my perspective, too, Andrea was really hurting. And we've got this couples thing. We do bicker when we're out there. We have to get through that. But she gets to this point, especially in the night when she's really hurting, where she's sick of hearing from me. And she has a lot of anxiety. So when she's got some injury, she just has a hard time thinking positively, getting out of it.
I need to know I'm going to be okay.
She needs to know she's going to be okay. But she only wants to hear that from me so many times. And so having Andrea's sisters there.
Yeah, because, you know, I'm wheezing and I'm having a hard time taking your breath. And Andrea's like, you're fine. You're breathing.
Fine. Yeah, you're fine. You're still breathing. Yeah, you got nothing to worry about.
I'm like, that's what I don't need to hear that right now.
Yeah. So anyway, my job became at that point, like, she's hurting. If I could just get her to her sisters, they would fix her mental headspace and she'd be ready to go. If they hadn't been there, I'm not sure it would have worked out. We needed that positive energy. We needed someone that Andrea could trust. Mm-hmm. No, they're not going to tell her she's okay if they're worried about her.
Right. You know? And my sister, she said that to me. She was like, look, if I didn't think you were going to be okay, I would beg you to stop. Yeah. And so the fact that through my breathing, through my lung issues, through my wheezing, through my knee injury, she's like, you're going to be okay. And that's what I needed to hear. I needed to know that I wasn't ruining myself for the rest of my life.
Yeah,
totally. I think that we know ourselves and we know we can trust ourselves. But when you're in the thick of it, sometimes you need to be able to trust somebody else to tell you that you're actually okay. So you have to trust that person's not just saying that, you know?
Right. Yeah. And that was also something that Andrew's sister really brought to the table too. Every time she saw me, she was like, you can do this. Like, you're going to do it and you can do it. And man, just everyone. And Dan, when we were on the brink of quitting, I mean, it was knocking on our door. I already said we were done. Yeah. I told Andrew we were done. I mean, the whole crew was behind us and said, look, let's just slow it up. And as long as you just finish, like, we don't, it's the, like, let's take our time, you know? So everyone was really behind
that
us.
That was like Dan's greatest moment, I think, in the whole thing, when we were feeling really self-conscious about how slow we'd gotten and we felt like we were wasting everybody's time and we were hurting. And we told everyone there's a 0% chance we're going to keep going. And then Dan sort of came down and he said, listen, you know, the crew's all behind you. We don't care how long it takes. You know, we're here for you.
We just want you to finish.
Yeah, we just want you to finish. And so that was actually really important for us to
critical,
hear.
It was critical,
I have like a million more questions, but I know we need to start wrapping things up. But you mentioned, you know, you're on the verge of quitting. And, you know, usually I ask people to kind of tell me their highest high and their lowest low and at the low point of the FKT. Can you talk a little bit about that moment of like being ready to quit and also like the rallying point too? Like, tell the story. I want to know.
I
think we both have a lot to say on this. I think the buildup to our low for me personally, not for Andrew, but for me, started on day 4 in the Crestones. And that's when we were heading up Humboldt and I was starting to feel my breathing issues, knowing that we have 5 mountains that day to cover and then Pikes in the night. So just having this huge just milestone ahead of us with these huge mountains was really stressful for me. And that's where I really started to feeling like I couldn't get a full deep breath in. My legs weren't working. And after significant events that happened that day too, I was pretty shaken up and we just needed to get down. We spent a lot of time out in those mountains. And so that was, I think, the start of where I was starting to fall apart a little bit mentally and physically. And then after that, we were like, hey, we need to just do a couple of easy peaks. It's been 4 days of just really technical peaks. So let's get into the cell watch and let's do a couple easy peaks. And then after that, we hit the Elks. And the Elks are just a killer for a lot of people on these records. We did Pyramid, South Maroon, and North Maroon. And it was there where we both experienced some wheezing and some more breathing issues. And descending North Maroon was really difficult for the both of us, just mentally and physically. And so I think it was the Maroon after the Elks when we decided to go back to the Sawatch.
Yeah, we were having such a bad day that we contacted the crew. Mm-hmm. And I remember saying, maybe we're just really exhausted. Yeah. And we need a little bit of a rest, you know? And let's get out of these Elks. They're kicking mm-hmm. our butts. They're really intimidating in the 14er record. In fact, if you look back at most of the attempts, virtually everybody stops before the Elks. I think it's just these huge, intimidating mountains, you know? And so we're in them. They're absolutely destroying us.
Yeah, and we'll put our tail between our legs and we ran
after
that.
We're getting the hell out of the Elks. Unfortunately, we're going to have to come back.
Yeah, and unfortunately, we have to come back.
And our lowest day is yet to come in the Elks. But, you know, we're like, let's just see if we can do some easier peaks and get our feet back on the ground. And my sister warned me. She's like, listen, if you guys stop for probably 4 hours sleep of the whole time as we're heading over to Massive and Elbert, like, I mean, everyone thought I almost choked to death.
He was dying. He couldn't even breathe. Yeah. And I'm trying to hear coach him through his breath. And I just look over and I'm like, this is insane. I'm like, we're not continuing. We're done. Yeah. Record's over. Yeah. We're done.
And that was when the camera guy, when we got out and we're like, oh, there's no way we can continue.
Yeah, Riley opens the door with his camera and I look at the camera straight, square, and I said, it's over. The record's done.
And so he said, listen, when you guys decide to turn around on Massive, just say a little something for the video. And then, you know, it's cool. There was no pressure to keep going or anything. Andrea started walking. She didn't even bring her pulse. You know what I mean?
I was convinced we were done.
But magical thing happened. You know, you started moving, started loosening up. And we never took that step where we just couldn't take one more.
Right.
And before we know it, we're on top of Massive. And we might as well get that.
So our mantra kind of became like, okay, one more mountain. Let's see if we can do one more mountain.
We couldn't think too far ahead. There were still like 30 left. That's way too many to comprehend at that moment.
Right.
But let's just do one more peak. The next one was also super positive. Megan and Riley came with us and it was just a really fun time with them talking. So we got our feet back on the ground and that was it. It was like, let's just do one more mountain.
One more mountain. And what I think that we are most proud of coming out through all of these lows, I mean, is really, we really just beat ourselves into the ground. And somehow, from the depths of hell, we had to come back out and continue. And I think that's what we're most proud of, is that we just didn't take the quitting step.
Yeah, we could have planned this much better if we had originally, we're going to go for 12 days. We would have planned a lot more.
Yeah, or 11 days. We could have planned it to get some sleep.
We were so aggressive. We really slammed ourselves into the ground. And what we're really just proud of is that we were able to drag ourselves forward. And we never really got better. We never got our legs.
It was hard the whole time. The entire thing was just hard every day after day.
Yeah.
And you like to think, hey, we're going to hit an easier peak. But I mean, even when we got to Democrat, Cameron Lincoln and Bross, it was still really hard. And I remember going to my sister and she got out of the van and I just cried. And going into the night, I was just crying. And I'm just like, this sucks. This is so hard. And one of the easiest four mountains we have.
Oh, you've never heard someone express so much fear for Bross, I swear.
So it was just so intimidating, mountain after mountain, no matter how quote unquote easy these mountains are. It was hard. And it was a mental battle, you know, every step of the way.
Yeah. And then, you know, it wasn't until, you know, we were nearing the end. My knees were hurting. You know, we had a few peaks left and we were up on top of like Gray's. And I was
really
talking about, at least we've only got three mountains left.
Yeah, I was like, at least it's not 30 when your knees started hurting.
Right. And Andrea's had started hurting with 30 mountains left. And so, I don't know. We thought that was really funny. Yeah. We had a really good laugh up there. And the finish line was in sight. You know, only three peaks left. We knew we could drag ourselves through it.
Yeah, that was, I'd say for me, it was at that moment when I had three mountains left, when I was like, okay, I think I can finish this.
Yeah.
That's what it took. Three mountains left. I couldn't see the end before that.
Right.
And now we have so many stories we could tell of these hard days.
Infinite amount of stories.
You know, we had this girl when she was little. I took her when she was 11, started climbing mountains with me and my kids. And she was there. She's like 21 now. And we got caught in this horrible electrical storm. We all just huddled together and just waited the storm out. We had a night where we had to hike down to get to support. They had sent a guy up basically 20-mile round trip for him. It was raining on him. Somehow he got a fire going. We hiked down and he stayed awake and kept us warm for like 4 hours.
Yeah.
You know, with all we had was the fire. You know, we had so many of these, so many great adventures, like our capital, the Snowmass Day back in the Yelks. We describe it, this whole thing was like being in hell for 2 weeks. That's the inner circle of hell, reserved for the worst people. It was like capital of Snowmass. It was so hot. We couldn't even think. It was like we were getting baked in an oven back there, you know?
And the ridge that you have to cross over is called Satan's Ridge. Satan's Ridge. So we're like, we're in like Satan's like boiling
pot. Satan's fireplace or something. So we have so many stories. And in fact, we are right now, we're writing sort of like a day-by-day account, you know, while the emotions are fresh and everything. So, you know, if people did want to hear more about some of these individual stories that we didn't have time to talk about.
We'll be posting our write-up.
Yeah, we'll post that write-up, you know, on our blog, you know, so people could catch up on that if they wanted to.
Yeah, I'm really looking forward to reading that. All the details of all the suffering and type 2 fun. Yeah.
Suffering it was.
Yes. At the time, it didn't seem like it was going to qualify as type 2 fun. But, you know, when you do finish and you're finally out
and you're looking back and you're like, wow, what an experience.
And I'm really proud of Andrea. I have adventure racing experience in my past, and I've had these races where I completely blew it for the team, like where I went hypoglycemic, and it's the emotions are really hard to struggle with. And there were times when she felt so bad because she was slow and it was like, is her knee going to hold out? And so she was like lashing out because she had that emotional pain of being the one. And I'm so proud of her for pushing through and keeping going. I think it's going to change who she is for the rest of her life. So it's really cool that we got experiences together.
Yeah. It sounds amazing and awful at the same time. And so much growth and everything about it just sounds so amazing. And I really appreciate you coming on the show and sharing about that with me today. I really appreciate it.
Thank you so much. Yeah. Thanks for being interested and wanting to hear, you know, everything that we have to say. And, you know, we could talk for hours. So thank you so much. And we're just really excited to be able to share these adventures with, you know, share our stories with the community. And just honestly, if there's one thing that, you know, we've taken from this or I've taken from this and that we want others to take from it is that, you know, no matter how hard things get, you can always push through, you know, and you will get through it and there is an end. And eventually, you know, whatever suffering you're going through, it'll turn around eventually. And sometimes that's so hard to see in the depths of when you're in the depths of it. But, you know, nothing ever is for forever. And so, you know, I was just looking ready for that moment, you know, ready for the record to end and just to be on the other side of it and to be excited about what we had just accomplished.
Thanks again, Andrea and Andrew, for coming on the show. You can read about their FKT on the website, fastestonetime.com, and follow their adventures on Instagram at A2Summit.